We've got a pair of functions, F1 and F2, both locally constant, compactly supported on early algebra of PGL2. Here we have the Fourier transform. There's the inverse Fourier transform. And then what was J? Well, the tori that are compact give you one kind of contribution, and it just has, we'll just find orbital integrals. Let me actually write it in the most compact form so it doesn't take all lecture long just to write this one formula. All right, so the I is the orbital integral where we've filled in the square root of the discriminant as a normalizing factor, so that doesn't appear anymore. And you just have orbital integrals of F1, orbital integrals of F2 multiplied together and integrated. And then we have a minus sign, order of the Weyl group, the Lie algebra of the split guy, And then we have, it's just that normalized orbital integral, but now the interesting thing comes, this is the normalized weighted orbital integral. And then there's another term which is completely parallel, ditto, but it just, somehow, the roles of F1 and F2 get switched in that final term. Okay, that's our formula. Now we're doing an application of the formula, and this is, as I say, is a key. It's a nice way to do a key step in what Harshrunder was doing in that Queen's paper. Now I was kind of in the middle of that, so I think I need to recall where we were. We were going to prove the following theorem, and I had stated it. And now I'll sort of state it in a condensed form. Recall that G sub E, those are the regular semi-simple elements whose centralizer is compact. So they're the elliptic regular semi-simple elements. And they, recall, that's open. It's an open subset. And we can consider functions that are compactly supported with that compact set inside of the elliptic set. These are very, very special. And then the first thing was that we get a well-defined distribution, an invariant distribution, by putting, okay, the distribution that we get depends upon the phi, and it's a kind of smeared out version, an integrated up version of orbital integrals for the various conjugacy classes that meet the support of phi. That's the way to think about it informally. But anyway, you have this precise version. The test function, the adjoint action of G inverse on X, X self. But because of this conjugation business, it really somehow boils down to taking orbital integrals of the function F, which is the test function, but the only ones that will come in are the ones where the conjugacy class meets the support of phi. All right, so this thing, just the distribution, that turns out to be an invariant distribution. I mean, the integral makes sense. That's part of the theorem. It's an invariant distribution, and it's supported on the set ab G of support of phi. So take a compact set given by the support of phi and apply the adjoint action to it and move it all around. That's still a closed set, and this guy is actually supported on there. But then the essential thing that we need to see is that when we take the Fourier transform of that distribution that we get is actually a function. It's not, it can be expressed as integration against a function. And I'll just say this in a short version. Okay, we take that distribution, take its Fourier transform. It's a distribution, but it's actually a function. All right, and since it's a function, now I can talk about its values. But when you have a distribution that's given by a function, of course, that function is a locally L1 function, and it's only, you know, it's like all things in L1, it's only determined up to functions that are zero except off a set of measure zero. But the thing is about this function turns out to be locally constant on the regular semi-simple set. And that makes it possible, even though it's only a locally L1 function, to talk about its values on the regular semi-simple set. It's like, you know, when you have a distribution represented by a continuous function, then it makes sense to talk about its values at any point. But it only makes sense to talk about the values of the function on regular semi-simple guys, even though this thing is a locally L1 function on the Lie algebra. But nevertheless, it only has well-defined values on the regular semi-simple set. So you have to sort of think about the logic of that a little bit. But all right, so this is, it's a nice function on G in the sense of being locally L1. But here, I'm taking it to be a regular semi-simple. That's where it has well-defined values. They come out to be weighted orbital integrals, but if you're on an elliptic torus, the weighting factor is 1, and it doesn't do anything, so it's actually an orbital integral. In other words, it's the orbital integral for y of the function phi hat. This is when it's elliptic, regular semi-simple. And then when it's hyperbolic, it's the negative of the weighted orbital integral. And remember, weighted orbital integral means that we do not include the discriminant, the square root of the discriminant. It's just the integral. And this thing is actually a class function. This function is a class function. And so it's enough to specify its values on representatives of conjugacy classes. And here I'm specifying it on the hyperbolic guys that are actually in our particular one that we fixed, the Lie algebra of A. But then, of course, if you have something conjugate to that, the value stays the same. It's a class function. So I really have specified it at all points. Yes. That's right. So it's, maybe I should, let me actually write it. So the question was just to make, let's actually write the formula of something. So the definition of this thing, it's what appeared before in the trace formula without the discriminant factor. Okay, so it'll be an integral like so. Well, in this case here, AT is just A, so it's this integral. And then we have F. And then we have twice D of X, that weighting factor. Where again, X is the vertex in the tree obtained by applying the group element G to the base vertex. And we've only defined this WOY. We defined it for ones in this specific guy. And now I'm saying just take the class function you get by using those values on the specific torus, and now anything conjugate to it, just transfer the values over. Yeah, that's the logic of it. I now want to sketch the proof of this, but I'm going to give it in a form where, in some sense, it's an exercise. I'll write down what steps you have to do, and I'll tell you where the hard points occur. But what you should do at home is to actually take the formula, the local trace formula, and see that what I've said is correct. There are some things to fill in, and I think this is a particularly instructive thing to think about, so I really recommend thinking about it at home. I'll give kind of the outline of the proof in a series of sentences that you should think about at home. This is a good thing to do. Okay, of course, it's just for PGL2. First statement, no doubt about this. We may apply the local trace formula to the pair of functions given by F and phi hat. That's the pair we want to use. and therefore, well, we have the local trace formula. Now, that involves replacing F by F hat, and then you replace this thing by the inverse Fourier transform, which makes the hat disappear. Okay, so we get actually F hat, comma, phi, and we have that identity. That's the first observation. And now we have to, it's really kind of, when you think about it, I hope you do, you'll see that something very strange is going to happen, because we're going to take the local trace formula. How did we get the local trace formula? We used the Weyl integration formula on that thing we started off with, and then did some further manipulation. Now the really ridiculous thing is we're going to go in a circle, seemingly, because what you need to do now in the next step is unwind both of these things using the Weyl integration formula. In other words, sort of undo all that stuff we did. But on the other hand, somewhere in the middle, we did something that wasn't just the Weyl integration formula, because we had the calculation on the tree, and something happened. And so now when you unwind with the Weyl integration formula, you get what, basically what we want. That's the kind of miracle of what happens. But it's a fun thing to think about, so please do it. Let me just write kind of the outline of what I'm saying. So use Weyl integration formula. Again, I will abbreviate it. Weyl integration formula. We'll use it twice, once for each of the two terms there on the left and right. Use it to rewrite J of F hat comma phi as, well, you just have to do it. And this is the thing I would like you to do. No, that can't be possibly right. So there's a typo in here. I will try to remember to correct it before having it put on the web. And then use it again. But on the other side, as, well, this time what comes out is integral over the Lie algebra of our test function, f of x, times, and then something, f of x, dx, where f of x is this stuff here. So to save writing, let me say by definition, or this is, I guess, f of y, yeah. All right, so the thing that we wanted to come out as our answer, just this thing here, just call that f of y. By definition, that's what capital F is. And you see, when you unwind what we had, that pops out there. I'm going to have to comment on that because there's something non-trivial you have to do in the second one. The first one, it's really just the Weyl integration formula. The second one's the Weyl integration formula plus something else, which I'm going to discuss. But in any case, now we're done because these two things are equal to each other. And here we have the Fourier transform that we wanted to examine. Its value on a test function is given by integrating that test function against capital F, and that was what we were trying to prove. All right, so we're done, except for in this step here, there was something that I have not yet discussed, and you would come across it when you tried to do that process. So it's something not completely obvious, except for in second application of Weyl integration formula. Need the following. We need some vanishing statement. To come over here and let's look at what came out as the answer. Notice we just got weighted orbital integrals of phi hat when we were on the split torus. So you might think it's a little strange, because if you look back at here, these things occur in a symmetrical way. In the local trace formula, you have weighted orbital integrals, and you have also unweighted orbital integrals. It just depends which of the two bottom terms you take. So what happened to the orbital integrals on a hyperbolic element of phi hat. It seems like those are missing. Well, they are missing because they vanish. I mean, but that's a non, that has to be proved. All right, so in order to carry that out, we need something. We need the following. If we take the orbital integral for hyperbolic element x of phi hat, it'll be zero. Okay, so this is for all x in the Lie algebra of A, the split torus, regular. We need this. Well, to prove this, we need to discuss some further things. Well, to prove this, need some limits. But I want to say it's analogous to something that happens on the group. You should think about this Fourier transform of this very special, remember, phi is quite special. It's supported on the elliptic set. And its Fourier transform should have be thought of in some respects as behaving like a matrix coefficient for a supercusped representation on the group. And this vanishing, then, is like the Selberg vanishing principle. So it's really quite analogous. These analogies follow through in a very systematic way. Okay. Now, when I do these lemmas, there's no real reason to stick to PGL2. I'll just switch back to a general G. Okay, so we have G, our connected reductive group, and the lemmas concern the situation when we have a parabolic subgroup P equals MN, Fleury subgroup M. As usual, we have the Lie algebra, all the three corresponding, or four Lie algebras. Also, I need a compact open subgroup where we have an Iwasawa-type decomposition. So choose compact open subgroup K and G such that G is P times K. In the split case, we know that we can take G of O, but there's always something you can take to get the whole group. Now we need a kind of constant term mapping. We'll define it. We're going to have an operation which takes one of our functions on G and produces, roughly speaking, by integrating over N, the nil radical for the parabolic subalgebra, we're going to get a function on M. So I'm going to say something wrong at first, but I mean, a first approximation is that you would just restrict the function to P, integrate over the N variable, and get a function on M. But that's not quite right. Actually, the first thing you do is to average with respect to conjugation by K. All right, so the formula is, well, first, what's the notation? We'll write, as Harishchandra always did, there's various notions of constant term. This one he always put parentheses around the P to distinguish it from other versions of the constant term. But the formula is very simple and goes like this. You take, this is supposed to be a function on M. All right, and as I say, it's given by integrating over N. And what you do is simply put in this function that you get from F by averaging it over K conjugacy classes, over the K orbits. So we have F twiddle, and then X plus Y dy. All right, so Y is, we're integrating over Y in N. And what's the F twiddle? This is again a function on G. All right, so we get another locally constant compactly supported function, F twiddle on G, defined in the following way. By definition, just average it with respect to the conjugation action. I'm going to be sloppy about normalization of measures throughout, just to save time. All right, so that's just a certain definition, but you can see it reflects
Well, I don't know.
I don't know what to say about it exactly, but we'll see some things as we go along. In any event, this map on functions gives us a dual map on distributions. If you've got a distribution on M, we can now pull it back by means of this linear map and get a distribution on here. Here's some facts about that. Actually, first let me make a definition. And I'll make some comments on it, and then we need some properties. So for a distribution D on the Lie algebra of the Levy, we're going to define something on G, and we'll call it I for induction. Get distribution I P G D on G by putting I G P D on F equal to D on the constant term of F. All right, it's just what I said before, pull it back using the constant term map. Why this name of I, which stands for induction, and you see such a notation in the theory of p-adic groups, you have an induction operation from representations of the Levy M inflated to P and induced up to G, so that's parabolic induction. This notion here, this is why you make the definition this way, this notion of inducing these distributions is set up so as to be analogous to that. You can do a similar thing on the group, just with these, you'd replace the Lie algebra here by the group, you replace this by the group. I mean, there's an obvious kind of group analog of doing all these things. And if you do that on the group, then this operation on distributions really is completely compatible with the inducing of representations in the sense that the representation gives you a distribution, namely its character, and these characters induce the same way the representations do. So this is the operation on characters on the group that corresponds to inducing the representations, and then this thing is the Lie algebra analog of that thing on the group. So it's a completely reasonable operation to do. Sorry? K, yes, what about it? Yes, you have to do that too. When you want to induce your distributions on the group, it's exactly the same. You do it in exactly the same way. You again have F twiddle, you do the same thing, just replace this by a group element. Yeah, you have to do that. That's how parabolic induction of distributions works on the group. I wanted to state some facts about this. The most important case arises when we're inducing an invariant distribution. We don't have to assume that, but I do want to assume it now. So let's assume in these facts, let's assume D is an M conjugation invariant distribution on the Lie algebra of M, as it would be if it were a character or the Lie algebra analog of a character. That's the natural case. What are the facts? Then when we induce, we get something, an IGPD is G invariant. All right, so it has the property of taking an invariant distribution to an invariant distribution. But you would guess it should do that if it's going to take, let's work on the group, the analogous situation. If it's going to take characters to characters, the only reasonable explanation for that is that it takes M invariant things to G invariant things. But anyway, you can prove it directly, but I'll skip it. It's also and independent of choice of K. So it might seem unpleasant that we had to choose K, but in fact, the choice of K doesn't matter. And there's even a way to write the business without, there's an alternative way to write it that doesn't even involve choosing K, but this is the easiest way to explain it. It's also independent of the choice of P. It really only depends on the M. And again, you should think of what happens on the group. When you do parabolic induction on the group, the exact representation you get does depend on the parabolic you use to induce. If you have a fixed Levy and look at all the various parabolics containing it, you'll get non-isomorphic representations, but their characters will be the same. Their Jordan-Holder constituents will be the same, or the semi-simplifications are the same. So when you work on the level of characters rather than representations, then parabolic induction only does depend upon M. So it should seem reasonable here that it's again true, and it is. Also, independent of P having M as Levy. So we could write, but I won't probably, we could write IGM instead. It really is an operation going from distributions on M to distributions on G, not involving any choices. This is much harder to prove. This is relatively hard. The other facts are easy. This one takes work. All right. Now, we have to think about how, some more things about how this inducing process works. And I said here we were going to need some lemmas, and now I actually, this is just to get kind of things going, but now I want to actually give the lemmas. Lemma one is that the operation of taking the constant term commutes with the Fourier transform. That's a simple calculation, but it's an important one. You have to grind through the definition here. And you have to use the way the Killing form, which we use to define the Fourier transform, you have to look at the way a parabolic subalgebra sits with respect to the Killing form. It's kind of a standard thing of the Levy being dual to itself and the N part being dual to the opposite N. It's kind of, in any event, I'm going to suggest again in this lemma that you examine the case of GL2. But let me write it as a precise statement. Okay, so this thing commutes with the Fourier transform, i.e., if we take the constant term, take its Fourier transform. Now we're down on M. We're doing the Fourier transform on M, but that's the same as taking the Fourier transform on G and taking the constant term of that. Okay, so let me just say, so proof. It's straightforward, but I would suggest it's more valuable probably just to do it for GL2. So I would just say try it for GL2. Then you don't need to know general things about the Killing form. You can just do everything by hand. B is the statement that the induction procedure, IPG, commutes with Fourier transform. That just follows from A immediately, because induction was defined just being dual to taking the constant term. So this one is a trivial implication, but I just want to formulate the result. Inducing commutes with the Fourier transform. And now the Fourier transform, of course, is of distributions. Fourier transform of distributions on M and on G. Okay, that's the first lemma. Now the second lemma has to do with what happens when we have orbital integrals on M and we induce them. I mean, an orbital integral is a distribution. So if we start with something on M, that gives us an orbital integral on M, we can induce it. What happens? Well, okay, so the statement is, suppose we have an element X that's in M, and at the same time, it's regular semi-simple when we think about it in G. That's, of course, stronger than saying that it's regular semi-simple in M. M might be a torus, and then regular semi-simple in the torus wouldn't say anything. All right, so I really want both things. When we have such a guy, there will be these discriminant factors coming in, but don't be distracted by them. That's just these are just some constants that don't matter very much. How do we do this notation here? The M, this is still the orbital integral for X, but the trouble is X is an element in both M and G. and I just want to distinguish between whether I'm taking the orbital integral on M or on G. So it's just the usual orbital integral, but on M. And of course, that's a function on M, so it's okay. And then the statement is that, well, notice we're just actually using normalized orbital integrals on both sides now. Okay, we have that identity. Again, these are the discriminant factors, and I put the superscript M and superscript G because we have a different roots on M and G, and so we have different discriminant functions. I now have to distinguish between them. I can't just write D of X. All right. And so notice that this is saying, suppose I ignore, this is some constant here, not very important what it is exactly, you just have a constant here, but if you ignore those constants, it's saying that this distribution on the Lie algebra G is obtained by induction from this one, okay, up to that constant. And while we're talking about these things, notice because the Fourier transform commutes with induction, I could say immediately from this that when I take the Fourier transform of this orbital integral here and induce it, I've got the Fourier transform of this orbital integral. That's something to bear in mind, but I won't write it. Okay, so now I think for by way of proof, I was going to say something, but maybe I won't. I think, again, let's just say as an exercise, work it out for GL2. And, of course, we're taking P to be Borel. Otherwise, it's not interesting. But you have to use, in the general case, you have to use the integration formula that you get from this decomposition, that anything in G can be written as something in P times something in K. And that lets you do your integral, you can do any integral over G in terms of an integral over P, which means really an integral over M and N, and also K. So there's an integration formula that you need. Integrating over G, a function, is equal to the integral over M, integral over N, integral over K, of f of m n k, dm dn pk. And now in our situation here, this x, of course, has some centralizer. Okay, so let's put p be equal to the centralizer of g and x, of x and g, and that will be the same, actually, as the centralizer of x and m. All right, so it's in a maximal torus that's shared by m and g. Then I can, if I like, here, I can modify the integration formula in this way. And that's the mechanism that lets you reduce an orbital integral on G down to one on M in some cases, like this case. All right, so try that as an exercise. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so this is, normalized induction in the sense of unitary induction. Well, on the group, I do want to use unitarily normalized induction, but I wouldn't say that those discriminant factors reflect that. But that is what I mean by induction, though. It is normalized. On the Lie algebra, we don't need to, no. Yes, it does think about it as being normalized induction. That is correct, actually. You've stumped me. All right. Let's see. Let me get my thinking organized. So we've got the lemmas formulated, and now I want to explain why. Yeah, so I said that we were done, except we needed this. Yes. Okay, so now, well, I want to discuss why this follows from the things we've just been doing. I'm sorry? How do we think about the constant term mapping? No. What? Yes. And how do we think about it? So the question is, how do we think about, but I will just repeat what I said basically because I don't know of another motivation. How do we think about the constant term operation? And it's just set up to have the property that when you define the induction process dual to it, that's the Lie algebra analog of induction on the group. It's just defined to, and that really is its purpose. That's the main purpose of making that definition, is so that that will be true. Classically that came about because constant terms arose on GL2. You take a modular form and you take the constant term of it. But that integral, when you do the constant term, it's an integral over an n, over a unipotent radical, in that case. And so then it got the terminology got transferred to every other situation in which you integrate over n. Yeah. Why do we get this vanishing from the things that we've discussed as facts over here? Well, we have to recall that our function was very special. So phi is like this. It's supported on the elliptic set. Now let's think about what that tells us when we look at the constant term operation. What can we say about that? Well, the constant term was taken in two steps. The first thing you do is you average over, you do a K conjugation averaging. But a K conjugate of an elliptic element, it's a conjugate, it's still elliptic. So even when I do the very first thing, when I take my phi and look at phi twiddle, the averaged guy with respect to K conjugation, that's still going to be supported on the elliptic set because the elliptic set is a union of conjugacy classes, and we haven't really changed much. It's still of the same nature as before. But then what do? You restrict, once you've done that K averaging, you just restrict to the parabolic and integrate over the radical to get a function on the Levy. But when you restrict to the parabolic, it's just going to be zero, because the elliptic elements don't live in proper parabolics, right? That's the kind of basic property that they have. So when we look at this thing, it's just identically equal to zero. Because you don't find elliptic regular semi-simple elements in proper parabolics. But now we use the fact that when we take the Fourier transform, that commutes with taking the constant term. And therefore, if I take the Fourier transform of phi and take its constant term, that's identically zero. Okay, but we're concerned with a hyperbolic orbital integral of exactly this function. And by the second lemma, that hyperbolic orbital integral, that's the thing that's now, it's sitting over here on the right side, but where we have phi hat there, it can be reduced to some orbital integral on the Levy of the constant term. But the constant term is identically zero, so it's certainly zero. So therefore, orbital integral x of phi hat equals 0 by what I called lemma 2. Well, what's the next thing to do? Actually, now that I've finished that thing that was, I mean, I've sort of finished the things that came from last time, let me come back to this formula. I just want to make a comment. At some point several lectures back, I said that the local trace formula on the Lie algebra actually does have a spectral side in some sense. Even though on both sides you have things that look geometric, in fact, two sides are really the same thing, both of them are J, but except not really, because on this side we have J applied to these Fourier transforms. And let's look what happens, say, in the simplest part of this, on the elliptic part here. So in the elliptic part, we'll have J, and then instead of having F1 and F2, we'll have F1 hat and F2 check. So that means what's appearing in here are not we can rewrite them. You can also think of, I don't want to mess up this board exactly, but suppose we are working with the Fourier transforms, then we'll see here I H F1 hat, for example. But then by definition of what it means to take the Fourier transform of a distribution, that's the same thing as the Fourier transform of, well, now it's sort of awkward, but maybe I'll put it I sub H, take the Fourier transform of it, and F1. Just changing notation so it's less clumsy. By definition, here's the Fourier transform of the test function, that's the same as the Fourier transform of the distribution, I H, evaluated on the test function. All right, so that's saying that over here we have Fourier transforms of orbital integrals. But that's part of this analogy that I was saying. I told you that, in a sense, phi hat behaves like the matrix coefficient of a supercuspal representation. That's part of this analogy that goes on. But the Fourier transform of an orbital integral, that thing behaves like the character of a representation. So this is the spectral side. We have it's like in the Peter Weyl thing. We've got the character. This is like the character of a representation on our test function. And then the fact that here we have the other kind of Fourier transform, that's like the fact that in the Peter Weyl you have the contragradient representation. It's the representation is contragradient. That sort of matches with the two versions of the Fourier transform. All right. But now, let me actually help to back up that statement that Fourier transforms of orbital integrals behave like characters. So now I want to state one of the important theorems in that paper, or maybe papers, the two papers by Harris Chandra that had admissible invariant distribution as the first three words in the title. There was the preliminary version and then the later version with the full proofs by DeBacher and Sally. I won't discuss the proof for all the elements, as you'll see, but I will state it like this. For every element in the Lie algebra, it could be singular, it could be nilpotent, whatever. But for any element in the Lie algebra, if we look at the orbital integral with respect to that, the orbit of that element, take its Fourier transform, if this thing is supposed to be like a character, it should be a function. I mean, that's part of the theory on the group. And that's actually, these papers of Harris Chandra I just referred to, that was the end result of them, was the statement that on the group, when you take the distribution character of a representation on a Piatta group, it's actually a function, a locally L1 function. And what we're seeing here is the Lie algebra analog of that statement. And the way Harris Chandra proved the statement on the group was to prove it first on the Lie algebra and then use the exponential map and other considerations to prove it on the group. So this statement on the Lie algebra is both interesting in its own right, and also it was a key step in his proof of local integrability of characters on the p-adic group. So for every element of the algebra, the orbital integral is a nice function a locally integrable function on G, locally constant on a regular set. In other words, of the same type that we were just seeing in the theorem before. All right, but the previous theorem didn't tell us this about orbital integrals. It said when you take that distribution I sub phi, which was a kind of smeared out version of orbital integrals, that its Fourier transform was of this kind. All right, so we don't know that this is true, that we need to find some way to prove this using the previous result. This comes from the previous one. But as I said, I don't want to make life easier. I'm not going to discuss the general case. I'm going to discuss the case where X is regular semi-simple. Even though they're all important, including the nilpotent ones, but let's just discuss the regular semi-simple case. It's all very, very interesting to know that the Fourier transform of a regular semi-simple orbital integral is a function. One thing to say before starting is that, of course, if you're in the case of a torus, then this is true. I mean, this also helps understand why these Fourier transforms should be thought of as analogs of characters. Just think what happens in the case of when your group, your reductive group, is a torus. And then it's Lie algebra. Okay, you take a Fourier transform of the Lie algebra, but if you're on a torus, an orbital integral is just a value. The distribution is just evaluation at some point. That's a Dirac delta function. If you take the Fourier transform of that thing, that is an additive character on that group. That's just how Fourier analysis works. So you have a distribution, which is a Dirac at a point. The Fourier transform is the additive character on that additive group specified by that point. And now if you write it out in the real case, there's not so much difference between a character on R and a character on R star. Okay, so where Haarschrunder first did things in the real case. And then if you have a one-dimensional torus, you have R star. If you look at its Lie algebra, you have R. The exponential map makes those almost the same. You know, up to a group of order 2, they're the same. In the p-adic case, the relation isn't quite as tight, but still. But anyway, that helps to maybe psychologically recognize that, yes, these things are like, they should be like characters. It's actually reasonable. But anyway, here's our goal. Prove it for regular semi-simple guys. And first thing is a reduction step. If you think about what we've done so far, when I had those distributions I sub phi, those only saw elliptic elements because we took functions phi supported on the elliptic set. And that means we need some way to get from elliptic elements to general regular semi-simple elements. And that's the first thing. That uses these same kinds of things about induction and parabolics and so on. So the reduction step, maybe I can call it parabolic descent, which is the kind of thing I was talking about in lemmas 1 and 2. All right. So we reduce to case in which X is elliptic as follows. Things we have to do. I want to go, well, let's, so my x is regular semi-simple, And then that gives us a centralizer, which is T. That gives us A sub T. That gives us M. Just like we've been talking about the last couple days, M is going to be the centralizer of the split component A sub T. And now I want to choose a parabolic P with that M. Okay, so we have to do all those things. And the effect of this is that now X is going to be inside of M, and it's going to be elliptic in M, even though it was not necessarily elliptic in G. So this is going to be our reduction step. You can always, by choosing the smallest levy containing your torus T, you can reduce the elliptic case in this way. So what things do we have to say? Well, lemma 2 tells us that up to a constant, when we parabolically induce the orbital integral on M for X, we get the orbital integral on G for X. We already discussed that. The constant comes from those square roots of the discriminant, so I don't care about it. That's lemma 2. Lemma 1, this tells us that, so I said it when we talked about it, but now I'll put it in here. The induction process commutes with Fourier transform, so I can simply put in the Fourier transform. Now, what is this telling us? This is the guy that we need to understand. We want to argue that this Fourier transform here is a nice function. We now know that it's obtained up to a constant from inducing something which now, if this is supposed to be a reduction step, so we're going to assume that we do know that this one's a nice function. So this we can, so suppose we know this is a nice function. I want to argue that it actually doesn't matter what comes out here. If you have a distribution that's given by integration against a nice function on M and you induce it, you'll get a distribution which is given by integration against a nice function on G. It's just a general fact about this induction process that distributions given by nice functions are taken to such things. And you prove that. So now you, again, use the Weyl integration formula. That implies that if you induce from P to G a nice function, that is a nice function. And although I'm not going to write it down to save time, there's even a formula. You can write an explicit formula for the function on G that you get in terms of the function you started with on M. All right, that's another application of the Weyl integration formula, which is used over and over. Yeah. Well, I want to simply, if my guy is elliptic, I do nothing. M equals G. Okay? But if it's not elliptic, I take the smallest levy containing it. That's how it's obtained. But it's also obtained as you do it in a several-step process. Take the element, take the centralizer, that's a maximal torus, take the split component of that, take the centralizer of that split component. All right, that's the end of the reduction step. That says if we can do it for elliptic guys on all the levies, then we're in business. All right, so let's just running short on time here, but I now want to assume that we're in the elliptic case. Okay, so now I'll assume it's elliptic. Again, let's take its centralizer T. That's the unique, and then the little t is the Lie algebra. X will be in there. All right, so we have this situation here, where X is a regular element in this Cartan subalgebra T, and T is elliptic, compact monocenter. What I want to do is to choose a compact open neighborhood of X in here. Just choose it. Why am I doing that? It's because we have some information about what happens when we have smeared out orbital integrals. And so I'm now going to be dealing with functions phi, like we had earlier, that come basically from this omega t. I want just things that are close to x. All right, so now let me... I don't know if I can get through this next claim or not. Let me try. I claim that the orbital integral that we're interested in, Ox, lies in the closure. Of the following thing, span. Well, of just I phi. What am I doing now? I'm taking we have distributions I phi for each phi that was supported on the elliptic set. And right now I'm actually making a more stringent condition because we're taking things which are supported not just on the elliptic set. I mean, after all, I mean, okay, omega t is in part of, omega t is in the elliptic set, but I want just things that are in omega t or, well, conjugate to something in omega t. So it's even more restrictive than before. And I'm claiming that Ox lies in the closure of this linear subspace. I mean, what does this sit inside of? This sits inside of just distributions on G. This is a distribution on G living in that linear space. That's a vector subspace of it. And I claim it lies in the closure. What do I mean by closure? I'm using the topology of pointwise convergence, but where we give the complex numbers, these things are linear functionals, right? So a linear functional is just a function on G. And you can ask about pointwise convergence, but I just give the discrete topology to the complex numbers. In other words, it's not really something about topological vector space. This is just an algebraic thing where, we use a topology here. If you have some distributions d sub, I don't know, alpha, suppose you have a directed set alpha. Okay, so suppose you have a family of distributions d labeled by elements in a directed set alpha. You say that d alpha converges to d. It just means that d alpha of f converges to D of F for all test functions F, but where convergence means is eventually equal to, because we're using the discrete topology. So convergence just means that once you get far out in your directed set, this thing is equal to this thing. All I did was formulate the claim. Next time we'll just take up where we left off. So we need to prove the claim and complete the proof of the theorem. And then there'll be some other things I wanted to discuss to kind of wrap up the course. But we're getting close to having a kind of a self-contained little picture of a certain portion of harmonic analysis now.